Looked, and I hope you have, if you've looked at the last section, it's really just a detailed description of that last 40-ish years before the coming of Christ. And so the page that we're on there, page 44, doesn't, it just gives us the outline, so to speak, and then we've got the details after that. And essentially, starting in 40, we're dealing with Herod. And, of course, Herod is the major player in the life of Christ, or preceding the life of Christ and up until his birth that we become acquainted with in the New Testament. Excuse me. So, just quickly, at the latter portion of that page 44, we've got Octavian, who, by the way, he took on the name Augustus. So, Augustus Caesar is the same person as Octavian, and he's vying for control, for power. Of course, he accomplishes that. As we'll see, let me see back over here. On your handout that has the table of the chronological list of these rulers, you've got the end of the Hasmonean rule, which we'll talk about tonight. And then the beginning of the Roman rule, coming down to the time of Herod. And, of course, Herod died in 4 B.C. So, Octavian, Augustus, was declared the supreme ruler over the Roman Empire in 27. But that didn't end the conflict. It continues, as we'll see in our discussion further. So, as far as the end of the Hasmoneans, and again, the Hasmoneans were characterized by the fact that the king / priest was the same person under that regime. The Jews, of course, they could not stand these foreign powers that were exerting so much influence upon them. And during this period of time, there were a whole series of poems written, and you can get on the internet and you can read them. So if you're interested in that, called the Psalms of Solomon. They are not scripture, but they are, again, they give us an insight into the attitude of the people during this period of time. And, of course, the Jews hated the Romans. They especially hated Pompey because of the adversity that he had brought upon them. And it is the author, one of the poems said, "Pray whenever Pompey died, praise be the Lord who judges the whole earth with his justice." And then he said, "Punish us in according to thy will, but deliver us not into the hands of the Gentiles." So they had no affinity at all for the Gentiles, only put up with them for politically expedient purposes, as the Romans, of course, had now become the dominant power. Now, Antigonus was the... go back over here. He was basically coming down to the end of the line in the Hasmonean domain. The Idumeans, of course, were where the Herods came from. But you've got a problem here, of course. Again, you've got opposing political forces. Rome has her problems. Octavian in the west, Mark Antony in the east, and of course then Cleopatra down in Egypt, she decides to make a nice little sweet arrangement with Mark Antony. It was not just a love affair per se, it was a political, I think, coalition. But ostensibly, they were sweethearts. She thought by, she presumed that Mark Antony was going to maybe win in the battle for political power. It didn't exactly turn out that way. And so Mark Antony, I guess, fell for it. So he started neglecting the civil matters, and I guess he was madly in love with Cleopatra, and he let that go to his head, and it didn't turn out too well for him. So at about the same time, we've got Antigonus, who was Aristobulus II's youngest son. He was over on the east side of the Euphrates, the Parthians, part of that old Medo-Persian Empire. We read about the Parthians in Acts chapter 2 when we see those Jews from all these different nations that were together, and there were some from that region. Well, he was hiding out over there, and then he was I guess really just kind of a refugee over there. Then whenever he came back into the picture, he lures Hyrcan and Phasael into the Parthian camp. He thinks, well, maybe the Romans are kind of fighting among themselves. Maybe it's time to make a move, and maybe he can come over and kind of gain some power. That didn't work out like he had assumed anyway, or like he had planned. And he wanted to get rid of Hyrcan and Phasael, and so Phasael, I guess his name is, he recognized what was going on, so he committed suicide. Then Hyrcan, who was the uncle of Antigonus, he fell for the ploy, but then what Antigonus did was cut off the lobe of his right ear so that he would be unqualified to serve as high priest, because any man that had a deformity could not serve as high priest. You can read that in Leviticus 21. So now Antigonus is in a position where he can declare, hey, I'm the king and I'm the high priest, and he changed his name to Mattathias. Now, you notice 40 B.C., and 40 B.C. is kind of a date to remember, because that's also the year that Herod the Great was declared king of Judea by Caesar. So all of these things are kind of happening about the same time. Now, Antigonus, he was a scoundrel. He didn't have much in the way of political skills. And we'll see a little bit more about that in a minute. Now, we talked about Herod entering the picture. He could see what was happening here. So he decides maybe one of the best things to do here is to marry the daughter of Hyrcan. And so Miriam or Mariamne, same person, who was, an older sister of Aristobulus. Well, he sees what's happening, decides you better get out of Dodge, so he kind of heads down to the south where the Nabataean Arabs were. And he left his family in a fortress down there. And he decides he's going to go to Egypt, because guess who's in Egypt? Mark Antony and Cleopatra. Well, what he didn't know is that Antony had already gone to try to make peace with Octavius. He'd gone to Rome. So Cleopatra thinks, oh, well, maybe I can just lure Herod into my political camp. And so she starts trying to put a move on him. Well, I guess he was savvy to that. And he says he better go to Rome too. And now we're at the top of page 46. So he didn't really pay much attention to Cleopatra. And he, sure enough, he arrives in Rome. And everything's hunky-dory. You know, Antony and Octavius both. And by the way, they were part of that, what is it, second triumvir? Yeah. And so, you know, ostensibly, they're on the same page. They're part of a, you know, three-man, you know, rulership. But, of course, they hate each other. But anyway, they're going to put on a good front. Well, so they welcome Herod. And, of course, what Antigonus was after was he wanted to take vengeance upon the scoundrels that had caused his family so much grief. Well, they played let's make a deal, and however that turned out, the obvious result is that the Senate proclaimed Herod the king of Judea, although he didn't have the country. You know, it's kind of like, okay, so what now? Well, he's going to have to go back over there and get control. So he can get Antigonus out of the picture, which is not going to be so easy because Antigonus has already been making all these let's make a deals with the Roman generals, paying them off to get support from them, get their military support. So he's got to break that up. And so, you know, first of all, I guess Herod must have persuaded Antony and his guys to send some letters to Antigonus. Hey, you know, you got to stop doing this. But long and short of it was, then Jerusalem was under siege for 3 months. And finally, Antigonus realized he couldn't hold it any longer. The Roman army comes marching in and, you know, kills many people. And now that just exacerbated the hatred of the Jews toward the Romans. Now here's Herod, who has just been dubbed king of Judea by the Romans. And now he's got to figure out some way to get that that stigma off his head, because if they hate the Romans and he's connected with the Romans, and yet Herod is pretending to be a Jew. In fact, in the course of this, it says that he was very strict in observing the dietary laws of Judaism. Ostensibly, he had been converted, but he was an Idumean, and he was nothing more than a fraud and a mercenary and at heart. And so you've got all this dynamic. And finally, Antigonus was captured. He pleads for mercy. Typically, the Romans didn't execute a king, but in this case, Herod saw to it that Antigonus was erased from the scene. And that's when the Hasmonean dynasty essentially comes to an end. With the death of Antigonus. And Herod is the main player now for the next 36 years. And beyond that, of course, there were his descendants. The Herodian dynasty is the next one we'll see on the charts. Now, as it says, and this is the middle of page 46 under Herod as king, the next period of Jewish history said saw the beginnings of national calamity, which, you know, lasted for about 100 years as far as the Jewish nation was concerned. Herod had a golden opportunity if he really wanted to kind of smooth things out and, you know, formulate some sort of a plan of agreement, sort of a kind of a Camp David Accord type thing, where you remember how that worked out. All the Jews and the Arabs agreed to live happily ever after. That was in the 1980s, wasn't it? 1980, we were in Camp David Accord. Jimmy Carter worked that out, didn't he? How'd that turn out? Well, that'd be like Herod trying to work out a peace agreement between the Jews and the Romans. It'd work out about like the Camp David Accord. But anyway, he really wasn't interested in that. He was only interested in what he could get in terms of power. He was obviously consumed with himself and all that he could accomplish politically, in make a great name for himself. And besides all that, he was paranoid to the core, as we'll note. And he was a servant of Rome. I mean, they buttered his bread on both sides. If he didn't keep Rome happy, he was going to be out of the picture. So he had to always make sure that he kept that foremost in his mind. He, as it notes here, he was born in 73 and died in 4 B.C., 69 years old when he died. And we'll note that it wasn't exactly a stellar occasion whenever he died. All right, so now let's move on just a little bit. He was declared king in 40, but he didn't really get control until 37. So it took him about 3 years to actually get control, and that was with the help of Augustus and also the defeat of Antony and Cleopatra in 31 helped to facilitate the and solidify the control of Rome over this region. Antony and Cleopatra are basically out of the picture after that. So Herod's going to do anything he can to stay in Augustus' favor. But Herod, again, he's a shrewd politician. I don't know if that just is automatic or what. You know, shrewd and politician go together like ham and eggs, but it seems like it anyway. So, you've got this, and we mentioned this after we talked about Alexander the Great, how the Greek influence had a tremendous impact on this whole region for nearly 300 years. Well, you've still got this Hellenization factor. And the Greeks were esteemed. What are some of the things that, even today, that the Greeks were well known for? Well, their language, but in terms of, feathers in their cap, so to speak. Well, yeah, their architecture, their buildings, yes. And what else? What happened on Mars Hill one day? No. Yeah. Yeah, and who were the guys that Paul was talking to? The philosophers, they were renowned for their knowledge. They were so smart. Their philosophers, the Epicureans and the Stoics and all those guys. Well, Herod was Hellenized. And he was very proud of the fact that he had all of these, sort of Greek credentials. So he's gonna try to, play over to the Greeks and those that have been Hellenized, even the Jews that have been Hellenized. But he's smart enough to know he can't just go over there and pound them on the head and say, okay, you're going to do it this way, or it's my way or the highway. So he's coy, and he builds some Greek cities, and one that should be always easy to remember in terms of favoring the Romans, the famous seaport on the coast, Caesarea. In fact, I remember that DVD that y'all have with that guy's reading the New Testament, and that's one of the things I noticed is he pronounced it, and he's a Hebrew scholar, isn't he? He's a Jew, so he's Jewish language is his first language. So I'm assuming that may be the right, correct pronunciation. Caesarea is the way he pronounced it. I remember that. I've always heard it Caesarea, but it's named after Caesar. Herod built it. It was a key port on the Mediterranean. So what better thing to do than name it after the guy that you're trying to stay in good graces with? Yeah. It worked. It worked because they were always, Caesar was always favorable to what Herod wanted. That still didn't change the fact that he was absolutely detested because he was an Idumean. He was a foreigner as far as the Jews were concerned, and, you know, even though he had ostensibly converted to Judaism. Now, again, if you marry the right person, you know, it may help your cause. So he marries Mariamne. The Hasmoneans have kind of, been slighted. So by marrying the granddaughter here of Hyrcan and Aristobulus, then that makes it look like he's kind of got an end to the throne, that he ought to be, kind of in line to be on the throne, even though he's already been declared so by Rome. But if he can at least make it look like that he's legitimate, then that maybe will get him some more people to support him. So he did that. He married her. Now, one of the first things he did after he got total control is he killed 40 prominent Sadducees. Now, why? Why would he kill the Sadducees? Why would he kill a bunch of Sadducees?
Well, when you're...
I'm going to say it. It says it right there in parenthesis, doesn't it? All right? They were not going to help him out. They were his enemies. And it's always about money. You always want to... You ever wonder why people do the things they do? What's the old adage? Follow the money trail? That is often a very valid course to investigate. Follow the money trail. Now, remember how we talked about the Romans were on the payola, the Romans, especially the Roman generals and their legions. They were on the payola, so now he, in order to maintain that relationship, he's still having to pay the Romans too. Well, you got to get the money to do that. So taxes usually go up and all kinds of other skullduggery. Now, the local Jews, again, they detested him. So he seemed to find some support from foreign Jews. The foreign Jews were not typically as devoted to Judaism as the Palestinian Jews were, because they had been, away from Jerusalem for a while. They had been under the, whatever political and religious regime was in the area where they were. So apparently there were a number of them that were mercenaries. So he could hire them. Well, maybe again it's sort of going to be in his favor if it looks like, I'm just trying to help these Jews out. They're going to help me out. I'm going to help them out. So that was, he added them to his army. Now, where's that statement? Caesar said, "I'd rather be one of Herod's pigs than one of his sons." I think that's a couple of pages later. Being a member of Herod's family was not something that was factored into the actuarial tables at the local life insurance company, I don't think. Or if it was, your insurance rates probably went up considerably, because your longevity was short. Your lifespan might have been short. Herod's own brother-in-law was found drowned in one of the pools at one of his palaces. Oh, maybe he would just, you know, ignore the lifeguard and run him when he should have been walking and slipped and fell. I don't know. But anyway, he was one of the victims, undoubtedly. When Hyrcan returned from Parthia, and again, Herod says, hey, you know, come on back. You know, let's make things smooth. Yeah, well, as soon as he got back over there, Herod accused him of treason and killed him. And then even Mariamne was executed, even though supposedly he loved her. Well, that's kind of a strange way to show love, isn't it? Yeah. And then he killed two of her sons, his sons, by her, because he thought they were plotting against him. And then we'll see, whenever he died, he had another execution order outstanding at the same time. He had absolutely no intention of letting the Jews regain rule or the Sanhedrin regain any power. In fact, he stripped them of all the power. They were nothing but just a shadow of what they had been prior to his ascension. The Pharisees and Sadducees, again, they were just two religious parties. They didn't have any influence like they'd had before, for some period of time too. And you can imagine what that's going to do in terms of the people that just cannot stand him. You know, some people are going to do what they can to get rid of him. So there was an underground, or several probably underground movements, which is not unusual. Young people formed secret organizations, and this all kind of melded into the party of the Zealots, or Zealots. They were adamantly opposed to Herodian rule. I mean, we read about the Zealots in the New Testament. And there were various conflicts between some of these guerrilla groups, and they would, you know, a bunch of them would kind of try to make a strike, and the Romans would kill them. So, I mean, this was going on. Again, this whole 40-year period from the time that Herod was declared king was just total turmoil and chaos, both politically and to some extent religiously. If they caught anybody spying, they would torture them, and everybody lived under suspicion. Now, when I read this and thought about it, I thought about Solomon's statement, "There's nothing new under the sun." What did this remind? Did this remind you of anything when you were reading about this? Yeah, well, and what about the political murders and all the underhanded stuff that was going on here? How about Hitler? How about Stalin? How about Saddam? How about, any despot? They're all cut out of the same cloth. They don't trust anybody, and they'll kill anybody.
Paranoid sociopaths.
Yeah. I mean, didn't Saddam kill members of his own family?
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of other people to boot? Yeah. So they will stop at nothing. Herod was this kind of guy. Okay, don't ever get the idea that because he had Jew tattooed on his, or embroidered on his shirt, you know, that he was in any way, in the fact that he built the temple, that he was in any way or shape, fashion, or form sympathetic to the Jews. He was not. All right. So you've got the non-Jews now, and he's going to have to rely upon them, basically, for any support that he has. Mark Antony, of course, had kind of been a thorn in the flesh and a threat to him, but then when Augustus defeated him, defeated Mark Antony, and then, of course, Cleopatra's out of the picture, that really helped Herod, okay? And their friendship lasted basically the rest of his life. Or, let's see, Caesar died before he did, didn't he? So, let's see now, we're at the top of page 48. So, Caesar Augustus, not only expands or confirms his kingship over Judea, but then he also expands it to Idumea and Samaria and Galilee. So Idumea would be southeast of Judea. Of course, Galilee straight north, right up the Jordan River Valley at the base of Mount Hermon. And then Samaria. So, you know, he gained a lot of territory as a result of the shenanigans and his friendship with Augustus. Of course, the Greek cities, yeah, they were not too keen on a Roman being over them. But that kind of worked to Herod's advantage because then he could play his Greek card. He was Hellenized. You know, and he could make it look like that he was helping them out, and in fact he did. And he brought some of them into his cabinet. Just these Hellenized locals that were sort of hanging around, and basically they were, as it says here, just a bunch of parasites. But anyway, he was shrewd. He really was. He could work. He could work the crowd. And he did it for 36 years, which is really a long time when you think about it, the way these guys killed each other off. But it was always, what can I do to get more power or get more wealth? And he built a number of palaces. Well, that, you know, we get into that next paragraph there about his builder. He built fortresses and palaces and cities and anything that he could hang his name on that made him look so great and wonderful. He encouraged the athletic contest. Apparently, he sent money even back to Greece, to Athens and Sparta and Rhodes, and constructed these temples and amphitheaters, and even made large contributions to the Olympic Games. Yeah, he renamed some of the cities. And generally, anybody that supported Herod was really just happy as a clam. Well, I guess that's why they called him Herod the Great. Other guys called him, Herod the Wicked or something like that. I guess it depends on whose team you were on as to how great he was. He did make a great impact upon the people, there's no doubt about that, and upon the culture. So, you know, he's gradually trying to influence more people to buy into the Hellenization. You know, he building the theaters and the Hippodrome in Jerusalem. So that all the foreigners that might come to visit would feel at home, you know. It's just like back home in some Greek city. And then, to ingratiate himself to the Jews, then, you know, he built the temple. That is Herod's temple. That's what it's called. I don't know if he put his name on it. But everybody, even when we read about it in the New Testament, it's always Herod's temple. It's Herod's temple. It took over 40 years. In fact, one passage in the New Testament says it took 46 years to build the temple. It started in, 19, wasn't it? That's somewhere in this. I think he started. So what temple did it replace? What the temple did Herod's temple replace? Starts with a Z. Zerubbabel. There's not too many Z's in, are there? Zerubbabel. Which, that was how long ago? Round numbers. 300, over 500 years, remember? Zerubbabel was in that first contingent that came back and laid the foundation in 536. Now, it was a while before the temple was built because they dropped the ball, and then Haggai and Zechariah had to go, you know, prod them to get back with the program, and finally, I think it was in 516. But anyway, roughly 500 years. So, it probably had a few whiskers on it. Yeah. It never really, I don't think, made the list of the seven wonders of the ancient world as far as its grandeur. It was kind of the, we don't have much information about it, but apparently it paled in comparison to Herod's temple. Now the Jews were worried that Herod was going to tear it down and wouldn't rebuild. So he agreed to leave it standing until he got his complex underway and they could kind of make the transition. And according to Josephus, it was quite a structure. It was, you know, white marble up on this hill, and the sun was shining, and boy, it just, you know, it looked magnificent. And it was. It was bigger and better than anything. Well, Herod, he's really going to be a real hero. But what did he do that kind of blew the whole project as far as the Jews were concerned? Have you read, anybody read this? Yeah. The symbol of the Rome. He hung it on the gate, on the main gate. I said he was politically astute, but boy, that was a real blunder. You know, how dumb. But he did it. And so that didn't go over well at all. And again, it just shows his true colors. Also, thinking about the way that he built the temple, he got the priest to work on the part that only the priest could go into, and you know, it looked like he was playing fair, so to speak. Okay, this temple was built nearly 2,000 years ago, or roughly a little over 2,000 years ago. What's left of it today?
The Wailing Wall.
Right. That's just one portion of a wall. You know, it was a big complex. It wasn't just one building. It was a whole complex. And I didn't get a picture up there. We'll throw one up of the model of this whole complex. So this one portion of the wall that apparently is left where they go now and they wail against the wall. So that's where the Wailing Wall comes into the picture. Whenever the Jews protested his putting the eagle up there, there were 40 of them that were arrested and burned alive as rebels. Again, he made his point. If you cross him, you're just about sealing your death warrant. Now, there was some semblance of peace, and, you know, he built these fortresses and built towns and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, I guess he could say there were some good things that he could be noted for. But the one thing that we should remember him, probably the most significant thing that we should remember, is students of the New Testament about Herod. And what was that? Right. He killed all of the male children 2 years old and under. And why did he do that? He's trying to get rid of the king that the wise men came looking for. Now, this is where we come up with the approximate date of Jesus' birth. We have no information anywhere in the Bible that tells us when Jesus was born. We know where he was born. We'll get into that. But not when he was born. Not the year nor the month as far as that's concerned. All this business about December 25th is all Catholic tradition. So, and also the wise men that came. How many of them were there? Trick question. We have no way of knowing. And by the way, where was Jesus when the wise men visited him?
In the house.
In the house, not in the manger. In fact, he was a young child, not a baby, when the wise men visited. Now, Herod puts 2 and 4 together, and he figures, okay, these wise men came now, so then the wise men, of course, left the other way. The angel of the Lord told him to leave the other way. So he figures, if I'm going to get rid of this one that's, you know, a threat to me, then I need to kill all those that are 2 years old and under. So obviously it had been somewhere in the neighborhood of 2-ish years. I don't know. You know, he might have just added an extra 6 months for good measure. I don't know. But since he died in 4 B.C., that means Jesus had to be born before 4 B.C., since Herod killed the 2-year-olds, it must mean that he was probably born somewhere around 6-ish, 7-8-ish, somewhere along in there. So that's as close as we can come to the time of the birth of Christ. Now, just almost got through, didn't I? The death of Herod. All right, so he gets sick, goes down to Jericho, one of his summer houses. He gets carried out to the warm pools out by the Dead Sea, and that's supposed to be therapeutic, and that didn't work. He gets sicker and sicker, take him back. Finally, you know, it's clear he's going to die. Well, he tries to commit suicide, and then people started wailing, oh, Herod's gone. And so one of his sons who was in prison thought, oh, okay, now's my chance. Herod had imprisoned his own sons. Now's my chance to take control. So he starts trying to bribe the guards. Well, it turns out Herod wasn't dead. So Herod had him killed, had his own son killed right on the spot. Now he becomes even more depressed. And then he was really bent out of shape because he knew that when he died, everybody was going to be happy. So what does he do about that? Well, he figures he'll just kill a whole bunch of people. It'll make everybody sad. So he assembled all these distinguished individuals from all the cities and locked them in the Hippodrome in Jericho. And with the orders that the minute he died, kill all these people. That way everybody will be sad, not happy. Fortunately, and this is all according to Josephus, whenever Herod died, that didn't happen. So Herod died, and now his body is taken to the Herodom down by Bethlehem. It was a fortress/palace that Herod had built. And I think the pictures are big enough. I don't have about to run out of time. But you can see it kind of looked like a volcano. But he built the fortress down inside of it. All right? And you can go to Google Images and type in Herodium, And you can just look at all these different pictures of the ruins. It was a pretty impressive complex. There's some diagrams of it. So, here he is in his finest gold crown and gold scepter and all the jewels on his gold bearers that are carrying his body up there and all that kind of stuff, carried and put in there. In 1960, they excavated the tomb. Not there. I wonder what happened to all those goodies. Maybe some grave robbers? I don't know who, but somebody undoubtedly got in there and hit the jackpot. That's usually what happened to those tombs like that. They just didn't get in King Tut's, but apparently they got in Herod's. But this is, Josephus said of the Herodium, there were 200 steps of the purest white marble that led up to it. Its top was crowned with circular towers, and its courtyard contained splendid structures. So it was a magnificent place, I guess, to be buried, although I don't think he realized that when they planted him there. So that takes us up to the birth of Christ. When, as John 1:14 says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So 8,000 years since, plus or minus round numbers, since the beginning, since the Garden of Eden. And now it's time for the Christ to come. Remember that God's plan was in place before the foundation of the world, according to Ephesians 1. And there come the kiddos, so that's a good place for us to start. And we will be opening our Bibles together next week and get back into the text.